government interference into what ideas can be taught in college courses, reduce state funding for state universities, challenges to tenure for professors, and actions to silence them from expressing controversial views. Is the public university under attack? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest today is Michael Bernard Donnells, Chaim Perlman Professor of Rhetoric and Culture, and Nancy Heff Professor of English at the UW-Madison. His most recent book is called The Vulnerability of Public Higher Education. Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thanks, Emily. It's good to be here.
Let's talk about why you wrote this book. You even start out the book saying that you didn't intend to write it. What led you to write a book at this point in time about public universities and their vulnerability?
I spent 6 years in the provost office at UW-Madison between, 2014 and 2020. And these were the years where we were reeling from the effects of Act 10 and during years when university funding was being reduced in the state of Wisconsin pretty significantly. And my work in the provost office also led me to see instances of faculty trying to do their work under pretty significantly straitened conditions. I think what happened was that I had all of this knowledge about how universities work that I had accumulated over, 20 years as a faculty member and then 6 years in the provost office. I had also spent time on the university committee, which is the executive committee of the faculty senate. I had been on the university senate's lobbying organization. And so I had begun to understand the relationship between university administration, faculty work, and state government. And it seemed to me a useful, a good time to try to sort some of these ideas out. And the one term that kept recurring for me was this idea of vulnerability, that faculty work is vulnerable, that universities are vulnerable, and that the mission of public universities was beginning to erode in some dangerous ways. And so I spent a couple of years poking around the history of higher education and the history of faculty autonomy, tenure, and that was really the basis of the book. I was really trying to understand the conditions of universities, particularly public ones, in these straitened times, not just financially, but also ideologically.
On the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, we have a plaque from the UW Board of Regents from 1894 when they were defending a faculty member with controversial views. And I'm just going to read a little bit and get your response to it. We must therefore welcome from our teachers such discussions as shall suggest the means and prepare the way by which knowledge may be extended, present evils be removed, and others prevented. We feel that we would be unworthy of the position we hold, this is the Board of Regents, if we did not believe in progress in all departments of knowledge. In all lines of academic investigation, it is of the utmost importance that the investigator should be absolutely free to follow the indications of truth wherever they may lead. And this is the part on the plaque. Whatever may be the limitations which trammel inquiry elsewhere, we believe that the great state University of Wisconsin should ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found.
I love that statement. I discovered that plaque and that phrase, sifting and winnowing, late in my career at UW-Madison. What I think it expresses is an early version of academic freedom. Academic freedom is a fairly recent phenomenon in the United States. In the late 19th century, a lot of scholars wanted to advance their knowledge in their fields and found that there weren't a lot of doctoral programs in the United States, and so they went to Germany to get their education. And in Germany, university professors had what we think of now as academic freedom. They thought of themselves as relatively autonomous, both from their institutions and from the state governments that funded them. That they had the freedom to teach their subjects wherever those subjects would lead, and they had the freedom to express their opinions about the university itself. And then those professors, having experienced academic freedom in Germany, came back to the United States. And this was in the 1890s, early 20th century, when it was fairly common for university presidents and boards to essentially listen to stakeholders, members of their legislatures, and essentially summarily fire faculty members who took difficult positions on controversial issues. There was one case in Stanford University where they fired a faculty member for their position on monetary policy and its relation to railroads. Leland Stanford, having made his fortune among other places, the railroads, Stanford's widow was not very happy with this and so wound up firing this professor. At about the same time, and this is during the Progressive Era in the early 20th century, a group of faculty members came together, faculty members from a number of different universities, and they founded what is now the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP. And they essentially wrote the key documents that established the outlines of academic freedom that faculty members in the United States enjoy today. So that sifting and winnowing plaque was really a kind of early shot across the bow to legislators and to university presidents that faculty have autonomy. They have intellectual autonomy, and they have the protections granted to them under the First Amendment, free speech protections. And that their jobs meant that they had to follow those lines of inquiry. And if they led to difficult or controversial positions that members of the legislature or members of boards didn't like very much, they couldn't be fired because they were following out intellectual trajectories, not political trajectories.
So what about the argument against academic freedom? In other words, let's say you're a taxpayer and you're helping to fund a land-grant institution, not a private one, but a land-grant university where your tax dollars are helping to fund it, and it's supposed to be for the state. And you hear about professors teaching what you see as radical, far-out, controversial views to young people who then may leave their rural home, come to, let's say, Madison, and be indoctrinated into a completely different way of viewing it. How do you kind of weigh the concerns of a taxpayer that I should have a say in what's taught with the need, the importance of a faculty member's absolute integrity when it comes to academic freedom and the truth?
I think one of the things that's often misunderstood about academic freedom is that it doesn't grant faculty members the ability to say anything at all. It doesn't give us carte blanche. Academic freedom is premised on the idea that we have expertise in our disciplines and that that expertise gives us the responsibility to follow those ideas out. And sometimes those ideas pan out into nothing. Sometimes scientific discovery leads nowhere. And sometimes discovery leads us into areas that we hadn't expected, that are surprising to us, that are that work against the grain of what we understand to be true. And that's the job of an academic. I think the other part that's misunderstood is one person's oddball idea is another person's paradigm. And the university professor has the responsibility to lay out all of the possible options for how to take a line of inquiry and to give their students the opportunity to also follow out those lines of inquiry. Challenging students is a very hard job, and being challenged is also an incredibly difficult position to be put into. The outcome is that you will graduate students who have the ability to sort through ideas, to critically engage with sometimes controversial ideas, and come to their own conclusions based on the evidence that's available, given the most present state of the research, whether that's in sociology or literary studies or biochemistry. And so to the extent that a faculty member will have the right to do research in their area of expertise and be surprised by what they discover, faculty members also have the responsibility to lay out for their students how they came to those ideas, the methods by which they came to those ideas. And having those methods in hand, I think, helps students engage critically with the world that they're graduating into.
Well, let me share another quote. This is from Albert Einstein. "By academic freedom, I understand the right to search for truth and to publish and teach what one holds to be true. This right implies also a duty. One must not conceal any part of what one has recognized to be true. It is evident that any restriction on academic freedom acts in such a way as to hamper the dissemination of knowledge among the people and thereby impedes national judgment and action."
I think that's an apt way to describe one of the ideas that I work out a little bit in my book. It has to do with democratic competence. The first part of Einstein's quote has to do with that disciplinary autonomy, that we follow those ideas out wherever they lead. The second part has to do with its relation to the public good. And ultimately, that's why public universities under the two moral acts were founded, was to provide an education to the sons and daughters of members of essentially the working classes. And the idea was that to the extent that they had an education, both in their technical fields but also in the liberal arts, that they would be democratically competent. And what I mean by democratically competent is that they would be able to engage with their fellow citizens at an intellectual level, and to understand how to argue with goodwill, and to essentially chart out the path for the public that would lead to the greatest good for the greatest number of people. So to the extent that academic freedom is curtailed, to the extent that the following out of ideas is tampered with or interfered with, we're interfering with the ability of faculty members and students to grapple with the ideas that are important to their ability to be responsible citizens and to engage with one another in well-reasoned, intelligent, and ethical ways.
As when Einstein is talking about national judgment, as if there's sort of a national need to have enough information and knowledge to act in a good judgment way. You mentioned the moral acts, and there is an irony there, isn't there, that the land that was used to establish land-grant universities was often taken from native peoples?
Yes. I think we're only beginning to grapple with that problem right now. It's the idea of the land-grab university, right? That the sales of land that funded universities, particularly in 1862, were often lands that were taken from indigenous people in the United States. The irony, the other part of the irony is that for a long time, universities didn't see native or indigenous people as full citizens. And so they weren't eligible, or they were not accepted into these universities. I think one of the questions that we're grappling with in the first couple of decades in the 21st century is how do we continue the mission of the land-grant university while also repairing the damage that came from the expropriation of land that those universities are founded on. And I don't think we've reached a very good solution to solving that problem yet.
You give quite a few case studies in the book of faculty governance, of things having to do with tenure, of sort of, who makes decisions. Is it the administration or faculty? Can you talk about the history of tenure? Because I think that's something that's fairly unique to a university system, is where you have a faculty member who is granted tenure to kind of protect some of this academic freedom?
The way to protect academic freedom is through tenure. Three ideas grew up more or less at the same time. And this was between the founding of the AAUP in the early 1940s, when a lot of this got codified in AAUP statements. They were academic freedom, tenure, and shared governance. The idea was that as experts, faculty should be able to have the principal say in how they judged the scholarship of the people that were entering the profession. For a long time, presidents did the hiring. With the rise of expertise in the early part of the 20th century, that began to change because faculty members began to question whether presidents who had very little to do with the fields that folks were hiring in, how they were making judgments about the expertise of potential colleagues. Tenure came about to give faculty members an opportunity to prove their ability to follow out the ideas that in their particular disciplines. And in return for their ability to prove their bona fides as experts, they were given academic freedom protected by tenure so that over the course of their career, they could continue to do their research and teach their research to students unencumbered by interference from non-experts, from particularly university presidents, boards of regents, and legislatures. The other part of this was shared governance. With the autonomy that faculty carved out for themselves as experts, they argued, and I think rightly so, that they were in the best place to determine things like curriculum, things like course content, things like programs of study that were formed around field expertise. What shared governance essentially lays out is a power-sharing agreement between boards, presidents, and faculty members, each according to their expertise. For faculty members, that has to do with the intellectual content and the pedagogy that surrounds it. For administrators and presidents, that has to do with the coordination of the array of programs and how criteria for graduation are determined, and for boards of regents, primarily their responsibility is fiduciary. All of those things, I think, go hand in hand, and one of the things that's troubling right now in the way legislators are treating tenure is that in eroding tenure, they're also eroding academic freedom, and they're also eroding the principle of shared governance.
We'll talk, too, about sort of more recent attacks on universities' freedom and governance as well. In the case of tenure, the only kind of equivalent situation that I can think of outside the university might be the Supreme Court, where once you're on the court, it's sort of a lifetime appointment with, I assume, the idea that you stay free of the political up and down. You don't have to run for election. You're not subject to changing presidents, you know. And are there other situations besides the Supreme Court that you can think of where somebody is granted a kind of permanence, a guarantee or protection?
I think the courts are probably the most clear corollary to tenure in colleges and universities. In fact, there's a wonderful statement in one of the AAUP documents that describes faculty members as not so much employees but appointees of the university. Of course, they work for the university, but they're appointed to do that work unencumbered in the same way that Supreme Court justices are assumed to be unencumbered by interference by elected officials or even public opinion. And I think that's another important piece of this. Like the Supreme Court, the idea is that these are neutral parties who are deciding on the law based on their expertise in the law and the Constitution. And public whim is not supposed to be part of their calculation. And I think that's very much true of academic freedom as protected by tenure. Not only are faculty members presumed to be free from interference from the university's administration or from legislators, but also independent of public opinion. Sometimes public opinion gets things wrong. And the idea of democratic competence is that faculty members are providing to their students the ability to sort really good ideas from really bad ideas. In fact, maybe some bad ideas that are held by the preponderance of the public.
We're going to talk more about tenure, faculty governance, academic freedom, and the state of the university when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
She got to write to get pubs. I need a grant to get funds. Her syllabus isn't done. I'm up all night to get tenure. We got to write to get pubs. We need a grant to get funds. Our syllabus isn't done. We're up all night to get tenure. We're up all night to get tenure.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Michael Bernard Donnells, and we are talking about his most recent book, The Vulnerability of Public Higher Education. We were talking about tenure, and you give some case studies of, you know, attacks on tenure, places, states where there has been some kind of movement to erode tenure or to reconsider it. Can you give us a few examples where tenure has been under attack, or a tenured professor?
Well, it's been under attack in a number of places. I think of Iowa, where, you know, year after year after year, some legislator in the state of Iowa proposes a bill to eliminate tenure. And I think in cases like the universities in Iowa, in places like North Carolina, Texas, Florida, where these bills seem to come up like Topsy every year or two, the aim, I think, of legislators in these cases is to have reach in authority to determine the kinds of subjects that can be taught and to remove the protections for faculty members. We talked earlier about the uncomfortable position that faculty and students are often placed in when dealing with difficult and controversial ideas. I think the aim to eliminate tenure is in part an ability to have some control over subject matter and to make it easier to get rid of faculty members who do cause discomfort among their students. Of course, discomfort is part of a university education.
Well, if we take the phrase ignorance is bliss, then knowledge can be an unhappy thing. It can be an uncomfortable thing when you start looking into difficult truth. One of the cases you talk about in your book is the unhiring of Stephen Salata at University of Illinois in 2013-14. You want to talk about that?
Sure. Stephen Salata was a faculty member at Virginia Tech University, and he interviewed for and won a position at the University of Illinois. And there was a delay between his resignation at Virginia Tech and his official hiring at the University of Illinois. During this hiatus, a war broke out in the Gaza Strip, and Salaita, who is of Palestinian descent, went on Twitter and made some very controversial statements on that medium. The president of the University of Illinois, Phyllis Wise, began to get email and communications from members of the community, from members of her board, from some faculty members, decrying that she or the university would hire somebody who would say things like this. To make a long story short, the board decided ultimately to not make official his hire. So not only had he resigned his job at Virginia Tech, he was out of a job at the University of Illinois. This was a case where controversial statements made by a faculty member really rubbed the members of the community the wrong way. And I'll be honest, I read some of the tweets, and they are, in some cases, quite foul. As a citizen of the United States, even Stephen Salaita had the right and a First Amendment protected right to make those statements. Moreover, under the principles of academic freedom, he also had the freedom to make statements as a citizen, regardless of his position as a faculty member. But because of the hue and cry of the public, a public that was largely offended by the positions he took vis-a-vis Israel and Palestine, he found himself out of work. He's driving a bus, last I heard, in Washington, D.C. He's no longer in academia. But faculty members have the right to make those statements as citizens. Now, does that mean they can say anything they want in their classrooms outside their expertise as faculty members? That's a very difficult question. But what happened to Salaita was he was fired because he made controversial statements, not as a faculty member, but as a citizen. But according to the University of Illinois, that didn't matter. It called into question his ability to teach, and for that reason, he was deprived of a position there.
I think in your book you talk about how, I don't know, I think it's about 38 states that have some sort of attack on tenure or a suggestion of, you know, post-tenure review or something that's going to challenge tenure. Can you talk about that and how widespread the desire is to kind of limit what seems like too much power?
It is a trend. I think the bills to eliminate tenure are probably fewer than are moves by governing boards to install some sort of post-tenure review, which is actually allowed under AAUP guidelines. Post-tenure review is a way for faculty who are tenured to undergo review periodically, usually it's every 5 years, to be sure that they're upholding their responsibilities as faculty members by continuing to teach in a responsible manner, to continue to carry out research. Usually these are fairly routine. And it's a rare case where faculty members are found not to be upholding their responsibilities to the universities. What's happening in some states, I think, in Tennessee is one of the cases that I cover in the book. It's not so much that post-tenure reviews are being put into place. It's they're being put into place without faculty involvement. Going back to something I said earlier, the idea is that faculty are in their disciplines, are the ones who are most capable of determining the bona fides of the people who are teaching and doing research. And so post-tenure review under AAUP guidelines is supposed to be undertaken and performed by faculty peers and reported to the administration. In places like Tennessee, what was proposed was a form of post-tenure review that did not involve significant faculty involvement and would have allowed administrators or even the university president to make a decision as to whether a faculty member was upholding their responsibilities as a teacher and a researcher, which, as I mentioned before, is would have eroded one of the key tenets of tenure protections and academic freedom, which is meant to protect faculty members from reach in by people who are less than qualified to determine a faculty member's ability to do their work.
And that's kind of talking about the content, what a faculty member is teaching, the kind of course, the kind of, you know, subject matter. You also in your book venture into the topic of faculty misconduct, including sexual harassment, and the kind of position that that can put a faculty member in, where they may stay in their job too long because of the protections. Can you talk about that?
I remember when I was in the provost office, cases where faculty members were accused of essentially not pulling their weight anymore, that they hadn't produced much research, that they weren't teaching effectively. And there's a process at UW-Madison, as there is a process at, I would venture to say, every public university in the country, that makes it possible for there to be an inquiry into whether that faculty member continues to perform their job as it's outlined in, let's call it, their contract. In those cases, as is the case at the University of Wisconsin, there is an investigation that's undertaken, usually by somebody who is in that person's field or in an adjacent field and who understands the nature of the work, both in teaching and in research, that faculty member is supposed to undertake. And it's only upon a recommendation or upon the, what, call it the release of that investigative report to an administrator that any decision is made as to whether that faculty member should or shouldn't continue in their tenured position. So again, the idea is that there's a process. Faculty are afforded due process. It is, I think, different in universities than it is in the corporate world. So if somebody is deemed to not be performing their work, corporate America gives human resources departments the right to terminate a worker essentially on the spot. University work is a little bit different because of the nature of expertise and because of the nature of intellectual work. And so an HR person may not know what is the proper course of responsible conduct or responsible duty in a university unit. And so faculty members are given a role to play in determining those cases where a faculty isn't fulfilling their responsibilities.
And in the case of sexual harassment?
In the case of sexual harassment, there are processes in place as well. I think that under current university policies, investigations are also conducted, in this case, by people who are familiar with federal Title IX of the Education Act. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the relationship of policy and justice. Universities rely very heavily on policies to judge cases of responsible faculty work, cases of misconduct. And in some cases, policy doesn't quite fit the urgency required. And there are cases of sexual harassment, sexual violence, where the urgency of addressing a situation requires prompt movement. And I think one somewhat legitimate concern about the policies at universities is that given due process, sometimes it takes a little while to dislodge somebody who is behaving irresponsibly or who is violating policy. And one of the issues that I talk about some in the book is whether we need to obey a sense of urgency, which in some cases might require us to go outside of policy in order to address really, truly urgent situations. And I think especially cases of sexual harassment and sexual violence qualify as those kinds of cases.
In the case of course content and course offerings, to what extent can administrators overrule faculty? And then stepping beyond that, to what extent can legislatures overrule administrators and saying that it's a state university? So I'm kind of trying to figure out the line of command here.
None. course content is the purview of the faculty member. Again, the presumption is that after 6 to 8 years of doctoral study and then experience as a teacher and a researcher in that area, they've gained a modicum of expertise and so are in the best place to determine that curriculum, along with a consultation with their peers who are also experts in that field and who are teaching in more or less the same discipline. Administrators should have no role in determining the content of a course because they're not in a particularly good position to determine whether the content of a course hews to the methodologies and the expertise of that faculty member. Now, we have departments run by department chairs, and a department chair is presumably overseeing the extent to which the course content does accord with the expertise of the faculty in that department. And so to the extent a department chair is a middle manager, they do have some involvement with the array of courses and to some extent the content of those courses. But when we're talking about deans, when we're talking about provosts, when we're talking about university chancellors or presidents, they, under the tenets of academic freedom, should not have any role in overruling faculty members' determinations as to course content. Committees of peers, committees of experts, These are people who serve on curriculum committees. These are people who serve as department chairs, advisors. They often talk about the array of courses and what's being taught in any given semester, year, couple of years. But again, this is done in the context of disciplinary specificity, disciplinary expertise. Legislators, even more so, should have absolutely no role in determining what gets taught in a university.
What about the Board of Regents?
Even more so. They should also, no role. They shouldn't have any role. And that's one of the things, going back to the Stephen Saliita case, that was so troubling about that case, was that the board assumed that because of the tweets that Saliita was issuing during the period of the Gaza war at the time, that he wouldn't be a good teacher. Not once did they look at a syllabus. Not once did they think to ask the department whether they had determined whether this faculty member's opinion on world events would have any effect on their teaching. They simply made a decision based on their own assumptions, in some cases political assumptions, in some cases having to do with fears of donors not providing funding to the university. They made a unilateral decision without consulting anybody who might have had any expertise in the subject matter that Saliita would have been required to teach.
In the time after your book was published, there have been more, incidents in the news, including testimony by three college presidents to Congress, leading to two of them resigning, and lots of calls for changes having to do with diversity. We're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. A university should be a place of light, of liberty, and of learning. So said Benjamin Disraeli. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Michael Bernard Donalds, and we're talking about his book, The Vulnerability of Public Higher Education. In December of 2023, we had the unusual situation of three college presidents under fire in Congress on the sort of topic of free speech and their lack of action. And I wanted to play just a clip from that. This is when Representative Elise Stefanik from New York fired questions at the presidents of MIT, of Penn, and of Harvard. This is the clip with the interchange with the president from Penn.
Ms. McGill, at Penn, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's rules or code of conduct? Yes or no?
If the speech turns into conduct, it can be harassment. Yes.
I am asking, specifically calling for the genocide of Jews, does that constitute bullying or harassment?
If it is directed and severe or pervasive, it is harassment.
So the answer is yes.
It is a context-dependent decision, Congresswoman.
It's a context-dependent decision. That's your testimony today. Calling for the genocide of Jews is depending upon the context. That is not bullying or harassment. This is the easiest question to answer yes, Ms. McGill. So is your testimony that you will not answer yes?
If it is, if the speech
becomes, yes or
no. If the speech becomes conduct, it can be harassment, yes.
Conduct meaning committing the act of genocide? The speech is not harassment? This is unacceptable, Ms. McGill. I'm gonna give you one more opportunity for the world to see your answer. Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's code of conduct when it comes to bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
It can be harassment.
The answer is yes.
It seems that exchange kind of points to what you were talking about, where the university finds itself in a difficult position sometimes where they have to defend academic freedom and freedom of speech. At the same time, they're under pressure to make sure that they're not embracing hate speech or controversial ideas that might incite violence or, harmful things. They're supposed to protect the public good. What's your response to the interchange there and the fact that, in a couple cases, the presidents had to resign?
The first thing I'd say is that wasn't so much a hearing as it was a kind of tribunal. I think that the kinds of questions, particularly toward the end of that hearing, were simply unfair gotcha questions. And the responses by the university presidents maybe didn't paint them in the best light. But I think all three of them were talking about the very delicate balance between trying to preserve universities as a place where difficult ideas are confronted head on, and confronted head on in a way that sometimes can be troubling, sometimes can be offensive, while also allowing universities to be a space where everybody has the ability to participate in those discussions without feeling as though their speech is being curtailed and without feeling like their identity or their personal affiliations are being called into question. There's a scholar of free speech at University of Pennsylvania, where one of these presidents presides, named Sigal Ben Porath, and she talks about the idea of inclusive freedom. It's a way of understanding how to balance campus speech with the need to allow and to create an atmosphere where all members of the university community feel as though they are full people who have the capacity to engage in the conversation. And I think one of the issues that the university presidents were trying to balance was just how this idea of inclusive freedom would play out at their universities. Where does speech from the river to the sea, for example, which is deemed as tremendously offensive and potentially anti-Semitic by some people, how does the freedom to say that impinge upon university students' abilities to feel as though they are included in the discourse and that they have a place at the university that allows them to respond to those kinds of speech acts? I think all three of the university presidents may have clumsily been trying to identify that sweet spot between the protections of speech and the protection of students as feeling like full participants in the discourse. But that really is the difficult balancing act that a lot of university presidents face these days. And it's also a balancing act that I think a lot of faculty members face when teaching difficult subjects, such as issues around race or issues around gender or issues around free speech. So it's a tough place to mm-hmm. be in, and I felt terrible for all three of those presidents given the tribunal that they faced.
It is difficult to try to argue for the right to free speech, but then also to protect someone from the right to hear hateful things or to hear speech that might incite violence. It's a tricky balance that I know the ACLU has faced in many occasions, too, where they're defending people who are like Ku Klux Klan mm-hmm. or, you know, not Nazis or something. So it can be very difficult. You also talk in the book about affirmative action mm-hmm. and the challenges to that, the intention behind it when it got going, the challenges now, and the idea of diversity under attack. Can you talk about that?
Sure. In the book, I say a few words about where the idea of inclusivity and diversity comes from. And it really has its foundation in the National Education Act, where through affirmative action, universities, really all public entities, were encouraged, if not required, to ensure that people from traditionally underrepresented or underserved groups had an equal opportunity to participate in the workforce, in the university, or in college admissions. That argument, affirmative action, was often based on redressing a wrong. And over time, I think that aim shifted from redressing a wrong to ensuring that those who participated in the private sector or in the public sector reflected the community around them. So it came to be less about redressing wrongs than it was about trying to balance the nature of the community, so that it was reflective of the greater population. I think one of the issues. So I talk a little bit about the backlash to affirmative action and to diversity, and it has to do with the movements of the 1960s and 1970s that. Where students and some faculty members pushed for the inclusion of subjects like women's studies, gender studies, Latino-Chicana studies, black studies into the university curriculum, because students were simply demanding that their communities and their identities were part of the conversation. In the 80s and 90s, I think there was a backlash to that idea, that the idea, I think, among some sectors of the public was that universities were giving in to the demands that were, in some cases, made less through deliberation and more through agitation. And there was a move, I think, during the Reagan years and thereafter to require universities to be more more accountable to their publics as a way to curtail some of the universities sort of giving in to some of these demands. That I think some of that pressure for accountability is what drives some of the backlash to DEI today. That universities should not. This is the view of some people who are making an argument about against diversity, that universities should not be a place where people can learn about their identities or where issues of inclusivity and diversity have a place in intellectual inquiry, that universities are a place for intellectual inquiry and inclusivity, questions of diversity shouldn't matter. It should be all based on merit. This, again, this is part of the accountability argument. And I think what that's done is it's eroded not only the affirmative action impulse, but also the idea of inclusivity that universities have been working toward, that involves trying to make their communities look more like the communities around them.
Which you would think would be part of the common good, that universities are supposed to somehow help the community around them. It's come into sharp relief with budget deliberations. If the state controls how much funding is going to the university and says you won't have this money unless you get rid of your diversity programs, that brings in the faculty governance idea. Because if the state controls the money, and somebody told me once that the budget is where you see the values of an organization. So if the state controls the budget and they demand certain changes and the university has to adjust, that brings into question whether there's true academic freedom, doesn't it?
It does, in a significant way. I think what we've seen, I think, over the last 10 or 15 years, and the last 10 or I think the period between the late 1990s and the early 2010s was a period of relative peace between universities and state legislators. Of course, there have been dust-ups between legislatures and state universities, and state funding has decreased over that period, but there wasn't the kind of political rancor that you see since, I think, the 2010s, and in particular in the state of Wisconsin, since the election of Governor Walker in that year. What's changed, I think, is the legislature's willingness to override university policy, board policy, through legislation. And that legislation has effects anywhere from budgets to programs to DEI programs and initiatives. And that I think is a real change that we haven't seen this up until the last, I'd say, 10 years, where legislators have essentially been emboldened
to write legislation that overrides principles of academic freedom, that overrides principles of shared governance. If you remember in the state of Wisconsin in 2015, the legislature removed the tenure protections and also removed strong language about shared governance from state statute, forcing the board to create language in order to replicate what was originally in law. That was a bit of a canary in a coal mine, because I think more and more states are seeing legislatures do just that, in other words, to write laws that override the prevailing, I'd say, compact between faculties, administrators, and boards of regents and their oversight of public universities. I think you're right to say that the idea of public universities as serving a public good has gone the way of the dodo in a lot of states.
Final question, because we're almost out of time. You use the term vulnerability in your title and seem to see it both as a negative and a positive.
Right. There are two senses of vulnerability that I play with in this project. One is, I think, a more typical sense, which is vulnerability reflects a susceptibility to harm or a precarity. And I think it's fair to say that public universities and public higher education in the United States are in a vulnerable position. We do face the susceptibility of harm from boards, from legislators, from state government in general, not just through the reduction of funding, but also through their reach in some of the laws that we've been talking about. There's a larger sense of the term vulnerability that I'm also interested in working with in this book, and that's a general openness to others. It's a capacity to be engaged with others in an open way. It implies a movement forward, but it also involves a movement of engagement. And I think one of the things that I would encourage faculty to think about is vulnerability in that second sense. How the mobility of their intellectual disciplines, how the mobility of their engagement with students, how their capacity to move has the potential, I think, to work against some of the more pernicious movements against public higher education from legislators and from boards, and to work against the kind of stasis, I think, that a lot of the laws that we've been talking about will have the effect to essentially stop the kind of really, truly interesting, vital work that university faculty do.
So both a warning and a sense of hope. My guest has been Michael Bernard Donalds, his book, The Vulnerability of Public Higher Education. Thanks, Michael, for joining me.
Thanks, Emily. It's been fun.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.